We're not trying to time markets. We're trying to build portfolios with long-term demand drivers. There's always shiny objects that we call it that may pop up. Some of those may have merit to invest capital behind, but for the most part, we are trying to produce, you know, the building blocks of a portfolio, make sure we have the best managers, make sure we've got the best strategies, and we're building in appropriate risk mitigators within these portfolios.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Scott Davies, Managing Director and Co-Head of Real Estate at Hamilton Lane. With over $195 billion of assets under management and supervision and a 24-year history investing in real estate, Hamilton Lane is a leader in our industry. It was a great discussion, and if you're interested in or currently talking to institutional LPs, this is an episode you don't want to miss. Scott, welcome to the show.
Brandon, good to see you. Thanks for having me.
For those of our guests that don't know you, can you just take a moment and introduce yourself, please?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Scott Davies. I'm a managing director at Hamilton Lane. I co-lead the real estate team at Hamilton Lane. And for those who don't know, Hamilton Lane's a global private markets advisor. We're an investment manager focusing on the private markets. We have verticals across private equity, credit, real assets, and the like. So yeah, look forward to diving in here.
Yeah, we're going to spend some time talking about Hamilton Lane, but before we do, I always like to take my guests along a little journey, and I'm curious to know, kind of, how did you get into the real estate business? And specifically, you know, we could talk about your journey into kind of real estate investment consulting, but maybe let's start with, how'd you get into real estate?
Yeah, sure. I think this is always an interesting topic to hear your interviewees going through this, but so my story starts in Southern California. I grew up in a real estate house. My dad was an investment sales broker for Coldwell Banker in the 60s and 70s, right? Doing leasing and sales of primarily office buildings in West LA. So I grew up in a real estate house. We were surrounded by real estate people. And I think, you know, I really got into this business through seeing their activities, hanging out with their families. This is a group of really energetic, smart people. And I kind of got hooked really from the people and the relationships first, and then later by the real estate and the actual, you know, investment process later. But my story, you know, really starts in college. I went to the University of Oregon. I graduated in June of 2001. You know, like any college kid, I kind of took the summer and just expected that life was going to be easy getting a real estate job, and I'll start that in the fall when everything, you know, when I decide it's time. 9/11 happens, right? That was devastating for many obvious reasons, but it was primarily, you know, super impactful in Southern California. As a kid out of school looking for a job, everybody's in a hiring freeze, so not exactly according to plan, right? So I ended up moving to San Diego with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and we all got jobs and did what we could. And then in the meantime, I'm interviewing across the board, probably had, I don't know, 30, 40 interviews across around Southern California in different parts of the business. I ended up meeting with a whole bunch of people, like I said, CBRE, all the brokerage houses. I always wanted to go into that business. I ended up landing a job with CBRE in Ontario, California. So about 60 miles east of LA, for those who don't know. But I started with CB. In the first day, my boss looks at me and he says, "How do you know Joe McKay?" Right. And I think the interesting part of that is, quick sidebar, Joe McKay is a family friend of ours. He's a successful industrial broker and developer in the Inland Empire. And unbeknownst to me, he had reached out to my boss at CB and said, "Hey, you got to hire this kid. If he's anything like his old man, he's going to be a great real estate person." And so that's one of those things that, like, I've never forgotten, right? And it's something that I think is part of what I like about the real estate business. The relationships are huge. And the fact that he kind of took the time out of his day to go out and make that plug for me you know, I'll never forget. And so I ended up getting the job with CB. I was there for 4 years. And by the way, another quick sidebar, I've watched many of your podcasts before. And again, I think that really is one of the things that I always look to and I'm interested in is that relationship angle. This is a relationship business. It's a people business at the end of the day. And so I think those relationships are fascinating. And as I think about who are the pillars in my career, the people that I've looked to, you know, for guidance and how would they react? How do they carry themselves? It really comes out of that brokerage world, right? So my father, John Davies, my uncle, Greg Davies, who's a broker in Northern California, Joe McKay, Greg Wool, right? These are all brokers in the industry that I was always looked up to and kind of thought of as mentors. So back to CB, I started in fall of 2002. We were the investment sales team for institutional apartments, selling apartment buildings around Southern California. And I really met a lot of the, at least apartment managers, GPs that we work with and talk to today. I was at CB in between Ontario, Studio City, Sherman Oaks until 2006 when I, you know, this is the run up to the GFC. And in those days, it was pretty clear that something was different, right? Real estate was expensive. People were buying homes in different parts of the country and renting them out. It just felt very like something was going on. I had the thought in 2006, hey, I want to go to work for a principal. I want to be on the buy side of real estate and I want to go, you know, start a fund. And so I ended up leaving CB and I went to work for a small private, really a family office in San Diego. And so beginning in 2007, we looked to raise an opportunity fund, you name it. We were into all kinds of stuff, hotel development and condo conversions and restaurant ownership and buying debt. And so just all across the board, that didn't work out. 2008, I left and went to work for an individual in La Jolla. We were really trading in bank debt, buying scratch and dent loans, non-performing loans, and really trading them to regional banks. And so fast forward to 2010, I am in Southern California. You know, we don't have a big fund of capital to invest with. And I'm just thinking, hey, it's time. I've got to kind of branch out to something else. I go back to the Rolodex, right? Start making some calls. One of the calls that I made was to somebody that a lot of your listeners in the private equity world will know pretty well, Jay Fuel. Jay was the private equity portfolio manager at Oregon Treasury and kind of a pioneer legend, you know, legendary status in the private equity world. So I called up Jay and I said, hey, do you know this group that I want to reach out to? And Jay immediately says to me, hey, I don't know the first thing about real estate, but I know a guy who does. And that's Steve Gruber. And he's in Portland, Oregon, and he's starting his firm. So reach out to Steve. So really the rest is history. I've been in the same kind of seat ever since I started with Steve in July of 2011. And it's been really a great, great career ever since, right? My background, as I mentioned, was really on the investment side, the marketing, the brokerage, underwriting. This advisory business was new, but to Steve's credit, he said, hey, listen, you've got relationships across a lot of the GPs that we talk to, you know, the real estate business. And so it took a while to get up to speed, but that's really when my career in this seat started, was in 2011 in Portland, Oregon.
That's fascinating. And remind me, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Southern California. I was born in Santa Monica. I lived in California until I was in middle school. I actually moved to Connecticut. My dad moved our family to Connecticut. And then I came back to the University of Oregon for college. Go Ducks.
Got it. Go Ducks. Yeah. I know our paths have crossed a lot as a native San Diegan. I know we've talked a lot about your time here. So we won't spend this time going deep on that, but I do appreciate the context. So you joined Steve. You know, how would you describe the business that you joined when you joined it?
Yeah, When I joined, we were really an advisory real estate consultant. Actually, I should say a real assets consultant, right? We were doing infrastructure, natural resources, minerals, mining, you name it, for institutional investors, for pension funds, insurance companies, high net worth, multifamily offices. So the business really started as an advisory consultant. We did have, when I started, we had co-invest fund of one vehicles. So we were doing co-invest very early on. We were doing secondary acquisitions of LP interest very early on through these fund of ones. But really the firm was, the mandate was more as an advisory consulting mandate.
Sorry, what was the name of that firm at the time?
Real Asset Portfolio Management was the business that Steve started. And then that business was acquired by Hamilton Lane in 2017.
So it strikes me as very non-traditional to come up in a real estate family and go into brokerage. That makes a lot of sense. But the transition, it sounds like, went from, you know, sell side to buy side, you know, a few stops on the way to investment consulting. For our listeners who aren't familiar with investment consulting, can you maybe describe the fiduciary side of what it is that you all do? And then talk a little bit about, you know, what was different for you in making that transition? Because a lot of people tend to come up more on the allocator side or the investment consultant side and just stay there versus crossover. At least that's what I've observed through my relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a different, when I started, when I came out of brokerage, right? I don't know what this consulting game is. And so it was definitely uncharted waters. I would say that what I was interested in was the overlap in real estate managers. Instead of selling a building to a GP, we were talking to that same GP about investing in their fund and going out and acquiring assets. So the business that Steve started and I joined shortly thereafter was to partner with institutional investors and be able to bring the market to our clients, right? If you think about our institutional clients, you've got a portfolio manager and maybe one or two staff members that can help dive into the private markets. If you just break down real estate alone, there's thousands of managers, hundreds of property types, geographic locations that these investors can choose from. Our clients look to us to help them break down that market and build portfolios, make suggestions about how much goes into apartments versus retail versus office versus industrial, but also make sure that diligence practices are correct. We are spending appropriate time on back office and cash controls and track record and team turnover. And so that's really the business that we brought to in the services that we brought to our clients.
So the business that you joined with Steve, you know, and Steve's a legend in the industry, was sold or acquired by Hamilton Lane, I think you said in 2017. What was that transition like going from a, you know, relatively small kind of boutique firm to a much bigger firm? Or actually, I don't know what Hamilton Lane's size was in 2017. So maybe kind of talk, what was that period or transition like for you?
Yeah, in terms of size, at that time, Hamilton Lane was a couple hundred people, maybe 300 people. Today it's well over 800. We are a publicly traded firm. We are a global firm with offices around the world. Our team at the time was less than 10 people, and now we've grown into a team of over 40. So the growth has been really strong. I would say that I've always worked outside of CB, right? I've always worked for small firms. And that's one of the things that I liked about Real Asset Portfolio Management. We were a small firm. We were, you know, we thought of ourselves as kind of SEAL Team 6, as we can go anywhere, we can do anything. We're very, very hands-on. You know, my initial reaction to, hey, you're going to be acquired by a large firm was, that's a bad thing. We're going to be acquired by this big conglomerate. And I could not have been more surprised to the positive, right? What I found was, we talk a lot about culture at Hamilton Lane, and we always have. And I think that culture is very real. This is not a firm where we were kind of lost in the hierarchy of this organization. Hamilton Lane is and always has been very hands-on, very, you know, very appreciative of everything that we do on the real estate team. And so there's been a lot of support. And so I would say that I've really been lucky and kind of blessed to be part of this organization and to have the platform with the scale and the size and the people to kind of lean on has really been helpful for our business.
Fast forwarding today, what is Hamilton Lane's footprint, you know, across all business lines? Give us the 30,000 foot overview.
Yeah, I think our executive chairman, Mario Giannini, likes to say this is the biggest firm in the investment management business that you've probably never heard of. And I think that's probably even more so true in the real estate world. So Hamilton Lane is a 900 plus billion dollar investment manager. If you kind of zoom out at the 30,000 foot level, we have verticals in private equity, in credit, and in real assets, all across real assets from real estate, infrastructure, energy, minerals, mining, natural resources, all the above. Our business across the firm is investing in funds, in co-invests, and in secondaries. Today, the model has shifted a lot from what we were at Real Asset Portfolio Management, which was more on the advisory side, to more of a discretionary investment manager model. And what does that mean? That means that our clients look to us to continue to bring the market to them, but to serve as a partner in ideas, in portfolio construction, in pacing, in building appropriate portfolios, whether it's emerging managers, whether it's global best ideas, whether it's credit, co-invest, secondaries, you name it, we kind of touch all of those businesses. And across the different verticals, we are very similar. I would say that our team, the real assets team, is a little bit different in that we do all of that, all three of those structures in-house, right? Our team is constantly evaluating co-invests. We are constantly underwriting funds. We are constantly looking at GP-led and LP-led secondaries. And we're doing this on behalf of a really diverse global client base from institutional investors, insurance companies, endowments, high net worths, you know, you name it.
And you mentioned the real assets team is 40. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. We're over 40 and kind of growing by the day, it seems like, in a good way.
And what are the different roles and kind of how do you think of the composition of that team?
Yes. So like I said, I'm a managing director on the team. I co-lead the real estate business with Liz Bell. We have a list of or a group of principals, vice presidents, associates, senior associates, and analysts spread across of, you know, several locations. Our headquarters is in Conshohocken, suburb of Philadelphia. We've got a team in London. We have a team member in Singapore. And we're continually growing. We have a new presence in, we added somebody on the real assets team this year in Toronto. We added somebody this year in Germany. And so we are truly a global business and we think globally. And so, you know, I would say that the growth primarily is in Conshohocken. We still have an office in Portland, Oregon, where I used to work. And that office is kind of leaning a little bit more to the infrastructure side today. So the real estate team is really based in Philadelphia.
And you mentioned one of your jobs is to bring the best ideas in real assets, but across the board to your clients. Kind of how do you stay on top of everything that's going on across the different ways that your clients like to invest?
It's a question with probably a long answer. I think I would say that we approach everything, and this is not unique to our real assets team or real estate team, but this is across Hamilton Lane as a whole, that we approach everything with a really rigorous portfolio management lens. And so we have a house view, and then we've got what are needs of our clients. And so the trick is to kind of marry those two together. But the house view is going to say where you want to allocate. We think the appropriate portfolio in real estate is going to allocate this much to industrial, this much to residential, this much to healthcare. We want to have, we don't say no. I know we can talk about office. We can talk about some of the problem sectors, but then there's going to be kind of that other, a little bit more opportunistic bucket. And so that's really the lens through which we approach, regardless of market cycle, regardless of, you know, which inning we're in, which we've talked about a lot over the last couple of years. We're not trying to time markets. We're trying to build portfolios with long-term demand drivers. There are going to be, there's always shiny objects that we call it, you know, that may pop up with, that some of those may have merit to invest capital behind. But for the most part, we are trying to produce, you know, the building blocks of a portfolio, make sure we have the best managers, make sure we've got the best strategies, and we're building in appropriate risk mitigators within these portfolios.
You mentioned you're the biggest firm in investment management that nobody's ever heard of. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. I think, I mean, maybe a couple of things. One, on the real estate side, we've been very active for a long time, even predating me. I think our marching orders have always been keep your head down, get your business done, keep your clients happy. We haven't lost any discretionary clients since I've been working here. We've continually grown. And I think that's a result of us really being thoughtful about we're serving the clients first. We're making sure their needs are met. And that's probably been at a cost of marketing ourselves, attending conferences. And so that is something that we are trying to change. I think, you know, if you step out away from the US, we are a well-known business. We've made really great inroads into different parts of the world. My challenge on the real estate side is to kind of follow that lead, that the trail that Hamilton Lane has blazed, and make sure that those investors in different parts of the world know we have a big, deep, robust real estate team with a great track record. So that's something that we're definitely pushing for and trying to change.
So you mentioned before, one of your primary goals is to find great managers or the best managers. I'm sure we could take this in a bunch of different directions, and sectorial focus and track record are going to be, you know, givens. But in your opinion, what are some of the things that are table stakes that make a great or exceptional investment manager?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the most basic fundamental of what makes a great manager is we want GPs and managers to treat us like we treat our clients. We want partners. We want groups that have a strategy, that are kind of thinking about where the market is going. We want our GPs to dig deep, to drum up opportunities that may not be the most obvious. Every single deal is not coming from an auctioned, brokered, you know, highly competitive process. We get that question a lot of GPs coming to us and saying, well, what do your clients want? And my response is always, well, my clients are very thoughtful, you know, driven people. You should go ask them. What we want is we want to build a portfolio of high performing, thoughtful managers. Now, the track record is very important. That's not everything, right? It's also the team and the depth of the team and the back office and the scale. So we spend a lot of time looking through the strategy, looking through the team, looking through the track record, really drilling down and trying to realize or trying to determine who's got the best, the most appropriate strategy relative to the market conditions that can perform for us. The other interesting thing about our business is we work for a lot of different clients that have different needs and different, you know, they come in all different shapes and sizes. Some are committing $200 million into a real estate fund. Some are committing $5 million into a real estate fund, and they may want to do one commitment per year, or maybe they're doing 20 commitments a year. So the calculus is very different. And we are, like I said early, we are a solutions provider. We are looking to build portfolios that are customized for each individual client while taking our knowledge, our data, and our relationships in the industry and trying to build on their behalf.
I recently put out a LinkedIn post that was a little bit provocative and stated that real estate investment managers have a quote differentiation problem. And what I meant by that is, you know, like you, I've seen and heard a lot of real estate pitches and they all start to blend to sound kind of similar. You've probably seen more manager pitch decks than just about anybody. Are there a few things that stand out or that you're looking for that will help managers truly differentiate themselves? Because the reality is, with the volume that you and your team are seeing, before you can dig in and look at the team and the back office and the track record and all of those things, something first has to catch your attention. And I'm just curious, kind of, what are some of those things? Or maybe what are the some of the things that are automatic disqualifiers where, you know, you don't pass go, your deck goes to the bottom of the stack and you move on?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of what we're looking for is transparency, honesty, true partnerships, right? And I think we see a lot of, I wouldn't call them games, but there's ways to present a track record where it doesn't fully provide the detail that we need. And so that's always a little bit of a kind of, you know, I'd call it a turnoff for us. But in terms of strategy, I want to know that the manager that we're talking to has a thesis. They see the world in a certain way and they've got a strategy to produce returns that aligns with the market backdrop. What we see a lot are, hey, if you like industrial, you should invest in our industrial fund. If you like retail, you should invest in our retail fund. It's great. We're trying to dig a little bit deeper than that and make sure that the managers that we are committing to, we are partnering with, you know, A, are going to be long-term partners of ours, and B, are going to be, are really, like I said, really digging and using their relationships, their operational expertise, their sourcing advantages, whatever those advantages may be. We're always looking for a differentiator because I agree with you. It's tough sometimes to find the differentiator. And I would say when we don't see it, when it looks like a lot of the others, and maybe it's, you know, and maybe it's the fees aren't right, maybe the strategy is a little bit bland, that's something that can put it to the bottom of the pile. And we try really hard to give everybody a review. Now, I will say we've had a lot of people call us, email me and say, hey guys, I submitted my fund to Hamilton Lane. You didn't take a meeting. You know, that's a problem. My response to that person is we absolutely try our best to meet with everybody. There is not enough time in the day to take a meeting with every GP that comes across our desk. And so we really, truly try to be thoughtful and think about what could make it into a portfolio based on the client, our client appetite as we sit here today. Or maybe there's a manager out there that, wow, this makes a lot of sense. We don't have the capital for it now, but let's keep in close contact and maybe we're there for the next fund. And then there's others that, hey, we don't have a fit for this now. And so we're trying to be very responsive. But, you know, I've had discussions where it's like, we've been talking to you for 15 years. Do you know how many commitments or how many dollars have been come through Hamilton Lane to us? And the answer is this. And that's, you know, something that we want to invest in all the best strategies. But again, as you know, this is a massive market. There are lots of managers out there. And so we're really trying to dig deep and make sure we are selecting the best ones.
So in the investment consulting space, there's been kind of, I wouldn't say a proliferation of investment consultants. In fact, if anything, there's been a consolidation. There's a lot of pressure on fees. And as a result, some of your peers or competitors in the space have also started, you know, to have their own discretionary investment vehicles. I don't know, is that something that Hamilton Lane does as well? Or are you have you stuck purely to the investment consulting side of things?
We have not. We are actually moving away from the investment consulting side. We are an investment manager that is moving very much more in the discretionary direction. So if you step away from real estate, Hamilton Lane manages several commingled products. We on the real estate side, that is definitely a direction that we are headed. There you will see commingled funds, will not be fund of funds. It'll be more co-invest and secondary directed. And then The other piece of our business on the discretionary side is are these fund of ones and joint ventures with large institutional investors. Sometimes those clients are completely outsourcing discretion to Hamilton Lane. And sometimes there's more of an interaction with staff and the board. But when it comes to real estate advisory consulting services, that's not something that we, that's an area of the business that we're actively moving away from.
Understood. So when you think about these different ways that you can invest on, you know, with discretion on behalf of your clients, you've mentioned the commingled fund model, you've mentioned kind of fund of ones. What are you seeing right now from a client appetite perspective in terms of capital structures that are making sense for portfolio creation?
Yeah, listen, I think that if you think about just the pension fund world and the lack of staffing that a lot of these large pension funds have and the large dollars that they need to put out, there's a lack of efficiency, I should say. There's just no way to cover this many LPACs, this many co-invest opportunities, you know, this many annual meetings. And so there's a lot of, I think, need for a group like ours to partner with staff and help them cover the market. I think the structures that we're finding that resonate the most are these customized joint ventures where we can either fill a very specific void in a client's portfolio, right? Whether it's we want emerging managers, we want credit, we want co-invest, we want secondary, we want any of the above, we can structure a joint venture with that client to help them not only access the market, not only source opportunities, but monitor and make sure it's done in a thoughtful way.
When you think about the range of opportunities, you know, do you typically come to a manager with a specific idea, or do you typically come with kind of a mandate for some sort of a return threshold or risk threshold, and then you try to work with this investment manager to come up with a solution that may or may not fit the client's needs?
Well, it's usually the opposite way. It's usually the managers are coming to us and we're evaluating, is it a fit for this portfolio or not? I think, you know, typically we are saying we need a return and risk profile and we'll build the buy box, right? That goes back to our portfolio construction. We spend a ton of time with every client building the buy box, evaluating what is the scope of this vehicle. What's the risk profile that you're willing to take? What's the return profile that you're looking for? And so, and then we look to build, you know, to kind of build that box. And then we'll go out and it's really more, does this GP, does this manager, does this strategy fit in with the box that we've built? So, and listen, that's the way that we've been operating since back, you know, in 2011, when I started with Steve in the real asset portfolio management team. But today it's very much more of a discretionary business where Hamilton Lane has track record attribution versus the client itself.
So I want to talk a little bit about industry trends and sectors and all of that. But before we go there, you've mentioned track record a few times, and this is a hot topic. I've learned the hard way that the last thing you want to do as a service partner is get between an investment manager and an investor when it comes to debating their track record. I have a few kind of questions here, because one of the things that I've been hearing a lot about, especially given this, you know, the fact that we're coming out of this ZIRP period, the zero interest rate period, a lot of allocators or LPs and perhaps maybe the investment consultants are not giving full credit for track records over the last few years. I don't know how you think about kind of the recency bias for track records. So that would be my first question. Then I'll follow up with a few others.
So if I'm understanding your question correctly, how are we looking at the recent vintage of 21, 22 being underperformers?
Yeah, well, I think it's not necessarily underperformers. I think in the zero interest rate period, a lot of people, you know, a lot of performance is being questioned. Is it alpha or is it beta? Because rising tide lifts all boats. And so now when we talk about, everybody talks about track record, we care a lot about track record. You actually said it's not the only thing that matters, which is great to hear. But then there's this question of, well, what track record do you get credit for if you're an investment manager? I guess that's really the question.
we spend a lot of time breaking down track records and doing the track record attribution. How much of the total return came from cap rate compression? How much from the total return came from just market growth versus how much of the NOI growth that a manager was able to extract out of the asset came from operational efficiencies and just being better managers and operators of that asset. So it's really hard to answer that question, but I will say we look at every GP, every manager, every track record and try to drill down into where did that track record come from? What was the use of leverage? And it's not always easy to make an apples to apples comparison where two different GPs use the same amount of leverage. They use the line of credit the same way. It never happens. They're always different. And so there's a lot of time and attention paid to not just taking what the headline number looks like and comparing that against the vintage year benchmark return, but actually breaking down that return and trying to look through to, or is this manager a really good operator that can extract NOI growth, that has a track record of identifying underperforming assets that they have a unique skill set to turn into performing assets? That's really what we're looking for. But you know, if you think about the market a little bit, the market peaked in the first quarter of 22. So we are paying very close attention to during those pandemic years when multifamily growth in the Southeast was double digit, sometimes 20% year over year rent growth, right? How did the managers react? What was their deployment pacing? What was their ability to sustain NOI once those rents started to pull back? So I think it's super important not just to evaluate the headline track record number, but to really dig in and know who the operators are and what is the unique skill set that every manager has. And our job is to pick the ones that aligns best with our strategy.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it somewhat implies that in order for you to be able to review the track record at the level of detail that you want to, you need a pretty high degree of transparency and kind of data access. Am I thinking about this the right way?
We ask for a very robust set of cash flows, and we are calculating every return. We are calculating every number that goes into a report of ours comes from all the cash flows of an underlying GP. And so in terms of data, we have one of the largest collections of data in the private markets through our business. Like I said, we are an investment manager of over $900 billion in the private markets. So all that data, all those quarterly reports, all that information flows through, and we're able to harness that for a variety of ways. But yes, when we're looking at track records, it is a very robust set of cash flows that we're using to pull that from.
I don't want to get too wonky in operational due diligence, and I know you have big teams that do this, but I am curious, just as a general framework, how do you think about operational due diligence at Hamilton Lane, which is, for our listeners, the process of going through the review of your track record information and kind of all this attribution that Scott's talking about. So how do you think about the operational due diligence process? And then near and dear to our heart at Juniper Square is this idea of, you know, the client experience, investor reporting. Curious to know if you have any thoughts or guidance for investment managers listening to this in terms of how they should think about best in class reporting looks like.
Yeah, operational due diligence, I would say, is critically important, and it's become more and more important. At one time, we were doing that as part of our investment due diligence. Years ago, we decided to separate that out. And I think that was a really pivotal moment. We have at Hamilton Lane, we have our own operational due diligence team that is totally separate from my investment diligence team that does background checks and cash controls and all of the above. And I think it's really important to not let judgment get clouded. We all have our own biases. We like this manager. We don't like this manager. There is potential for that to cloud the operational due diligence process. And so I think this move of separating the two processes, making them distinct, was super important. I think for the managers out there that are looking to kind of crack into institutional capital, I think it's super important to focus on the back office. sometimes it's most important, right? I think putting the right people in place that speak that performance reporting and cash controls and making sure that you have all these boxes checked, it's something that we look at every time. And to be clear, we are an emerging manager investor. We're a first-time investor. We're a Fund 11 investor. So we have a lot of experience working with new managers. It really comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the strategy. Does the strategy fit with the objectives of our vehicle, of our client? And if it does, and if it's a first-time manager, we're going to do a really deep dive. And I think the ones that have succeeded and that have grown on to be partners of ours have really taken the time ahead of time, not learning on the job, but spending time with back office professionals, operational due diligence professionals, and knowing how to build that platform, because it's critical to us. It's critical to our clients. It's just too important to kind of learn on the job.
Totally agree. Well, let's change gears. We're recording this in August of 2024. Curious to get kind of your headline overview of what's going on in the markets right now. How would you describe things, as if you're talking to one of your clients and they're asking you for an overview?
Right. I think the markets are very interesting right now. I think, and I touched on it a little bit, it's always helpful to kind of put this in context from peak to trough, right? So peak being Q1 of 22, we're now a little over, 2.5 years in on this correction. I think I've heard a lot of talk about and read a lot about, is the bottom now? Have we passed the bottom? Where is the bottom? We are in no way trying to time that. But I think the interesting thing about where we are today is you're seeing interest rates coming back down. You're seeing a lot of potential transaction activity that may or may not be getting done because financing is still very hard. What we've seen over the last 18 months is really it's been this capital markets distress. And there are very real pain points of sellers have loans coming due. I can't refinance it because the rate's too high. My floating rate debt has taken all the cash flow out of the asset. So I've got to sell it. But meanwhile, it could be 95% occupied. It's got real year-over-year rent growth. And so it's not a distressed asset, but it's a stressed seller. That's what we're seeing today. We're seeing lots of pain points across private sellers, open-end funds, institutions. And for us at Hamilton Lane, it's really, we want to keep eyes wide open. We never say no to anything. Would I buy office today? Maybe. I wouldn't say no. Office is very scary. But we're also seeing some pretty interesting opportunities in office. That said, we haven't transacted on those. We are in wait and see mode. What we have transacted on, we've been a big buyer of apartments. We think the residential story is long-term. I think that the correction in what's happened in apartment properties, I think we're closer to the bottom than we are to the peak. I think as we look forward, it looks pretty healthy. I think industrial, we're definitely seeing some markets with oversupply as we are in multifamily. We're monitoring those. But fundamentally, the business of industrial logistics, warehouses has changed for the better. I'd say what we're spending a lot of time on, definitely healthcare, medical office, some lower CapEx assets, higher cash flowing assets, maybe a little bit more cyclical depending on what's going on with the economy, but think of self-storage or senior housing or, small retail or some of these other property types. Point being, we think it's a really interesting time to invest. We are not massively changing we're not looking to time markets. We are not changing our deployment, our strategy, but we're trying to make sure that we're covering some of the, all the best opportunities.
It's interesting because a lot of those asset classes that you just mentioned are considered, kind of the niche part of institutional real estate, if you will, and they're only just institutionalizing. Does that kind of pose any challenges for you in terms of the depth of institutional quality managers, institutional quality assets, or do you have comfort? Because like you said, you can invest with a manager at any stage, whether it's their first time they're doing institutional deals or Fund 11, you figured out a way to get kind of around those challenges from a market depth perspective?
Yeah, I think the challenge is working with, you know, let's say an operating partner that historically has been an operating partner to institutional capital that is looking to step out on, you know, and raise institutional capital. Like I said, we have invested with those types of groups before. It's definitely something that not all clients have the appetite for, a first-time fund without a realized track record. So it's something that we need to manage, but we have found ways to get comfortable with it. And I think it really comes down to the operational acumen of that group, right? And if the acquisition activity, the operational activity, they've realized deals, I think that realization is critical to us, showing the fact that they've got a strategy. They can build it, they can lease it, they can sell it, and they've done that in the past. You know, I would say that medical office is one of those industries where there's not a lot of, right? If you look at the apartment world, you've got apartment managers from coast to coast that are very good at the job. It's a very efficient market and there's lots of GPs. If you then look at medical office, there are a lot of operators of medical office, but very few relative to some of the other property types, and then even fewer with kind of the institutional fundraising capabilities. And so those are areas that we like. We like the aggregation play, you know, where it's hard for a large investment manager to come in and buy a bunch of small assets. We love participating in the acquisition of small assets, packaging them together, and then selling a large portfolio to big buyers. That's an area where we've succeeded. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for that today.
You mentioned before a part of your business is doing recaps or, you know, LP secondaries. And with the kind of limited distributions coming back to the market, there are a lot of institutional LPs who have kind of denominator effect problems, although it's shifting a little bit now, and are looking to exit their positions because they need to. How are you seeing kind of those dynamics play out? Are you still seeing the trend that institutional investors need to sell their positions, or GPs want to continue the investment period, whether through a continuation vehicle or the need to recap? What is that dynamic like?
Oh, I think the secondary market is fascinating right now. There's a lot of opportunity there. The ability to buy an LP-led secondary at a discount in real estate is pretty attractive. I will say that, and we've been doing this for a long time, I will say that as we think about our business, we are a little bit more bottom up, meaning that we want to underwrite every piece of real estate. We want to know every asset, every market. Whereas a lot of the opportunities that at least maybe we've seen recently has been more of the larger funds, lots of underlying investments. And so it's been a little bit more of kind of a macro bet, a discounted pricing bet. And that's something that we have not participated in a ton. But I would say, just generally speaking, that market is very much alive. And I think more and more institutional owners and pension funds especially have been tapping into that secondary market to say, hey, these are legacy managers that we may not be looking to invest with going forward. And I think that market's here to stay, and it's going to continue to be something that we're always going to look at.
So shifting gears a little bit to capital sources, I know as a discretionary investment manager, Hamilton Lane has a very robust business in the private wealth space. Has that private wealth initiative crossed over into real assets at this point in time?
Yes, it has. It's an area that we are constantly looking at. Hamilton Lane's been very successful on the private wealth side, and I think it's an interesting model for real estate. Now, considering where real estate is in the market cycle, we are in a little bit of a, you know, correction from the peak vintage. I think today is a pretty tough environment to go out and build a new business line. But I think long term, that is an area where we are certainly going to grow, and we're going to see some growth in real estate as well. So yeah, it's a big focus of ours at the firm. And one that we're starting to see our competitors dip into as well.
Yeah, it's something that we're looking at very closely as well. And I think it'll be interesting to see how the dynamics and the needs from a productization perspective evolve as you're relating to clients and private wealth versus institutional. Certainly, there'll be some convergence, but also I'm sure the requirements are going to be quite different over time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another fascinating business that is moving very fast.
So you mentioned at the outset, you guys have been heads down building this business, delivering great returns for your clients, or at least staying aware of what's happening in the market. This is your soapbox. So there's a lot of GPs listening to this. If they've made it this far, you know, tell me, what do you want to see more of? What do you want to see less of? Or let's just talk about, what do you want to see more of? What would you love more flow on right now?
Yeah, I think this comes back to, I want partners. I want to know groups are bringing me the best ideas. So I'm somewhat agnostic as to the property type and the location. I want to know the pitch as to why this strategy makes sense for institutional capital or for Hamilton Lane. And so that's what we want to see. I think, you know, I mentioned our kind of thesis around our portfolio construction. We are going to continue to layer into residential. We are going to continue to layer into industrial and logistics, and then healthcare and some of these other nichier property types, right, that I think are going to be here for a long time. And so that's what I want to see. I want to see, and I want to hear about why the strategy makes sense, why the risk is mitigated through operational capabilities. At the end of the day, this is real estate. We're buying four walls and a roof. This is not overly complicated. And so we want to know that operational capability is really front and center.
What's one thing managers can do to either cut through your inbox, your Liz's inbox, to kind of get your attention? I know there's a large pile, and I'm sure some people are going to listen to this and say, this is great, but, you know, like Scott said, he's just got too much on his plate right now. Is there any kind of tip or tactic, something that you really appreciate, or maybe the opposite, something you despise, and, you know, it's do not pass go, just so people know how to try to track you down?
And listen, I disagree with that. I don't think I've got too much on my plate, and I try to make that clear. We're always open to taking calls. What we need is patience. You know, we have a very kind of streamlined way of seeing the market, and that is, GPs should come to the Hamilton Lane website, put their fund in our registration portal. We screen it. That screening goes to our investment committee. And then we decide, hey, is there something here? Should we take a meeting? Should we not? And again, we talked about this earlier, but we just can't take a meeting with every manager out there. So what I would say to those managers listening is, have patience. Feel free to continue to let us know, hey, I sent this to you. I'd love to take a meeting with you. Here's why I think our strategy makes sense. And hopefully the stars can align, whether it's because the timing works out, or we may have a new client, or maybe one of our existing clients is deciding he or she wants to go in a different direction and add something that this person is offering. And so I would say that our business changes rapidly. We're always evaluating. We're always open for business. We don't try to shut the store window and say we're too busy. So I think patience is key.
Yeah. And I agree with you completely. I mean, real estate is the long game, and sponsors, investment managers always ask me the same question. And it's about, you know, showing up, being consistent, ethics, morals, relationships, and obviously the track record goes a long way. And, you know, just to set the record straight, Scott, you've always been super responsive and engaged with the managers that I know that have been in touch with you and otherwise. But there is this tendency for investment managers to want to say, I tried and I can't. And I think the reality is, you know, those who have the patience and can play the long game will succeed.
And the other thing, we try really hard to give direct feedback, right? If there is a group that may not have the ODD process under control, they may be very new. And so we try to give the feedback, hey, we are a first-time manager, but this may not be ready for our capital, and here's why. And so we can't give that kind of feedback on every interaction, but that is something, you know, that we're always trying to be as forthcoming as we can.
Awesome. So I think you mentioned it before, but if somebody wants to learn more about Hamilton Lane, wants to learn more about the team or how to get in touch, it sounds like the website is the best place for them to go.
Yeah, I'd say the website or submit an investment opportunity portal on the website. But email is really critical. And I don't try to turn anybody away from send me an email, make the intro. And we will try hard, either myself, Liz, somebody from our team, to reach out, you know, spend at least 30 minutes getting to know the strategy. And again, we'll try to be as transparent as we can and direct as we can to say, hey, we think there may be something here. Maybe there's not something here, but I think email and the website are definitely the best paths to get in front of us.
Awesome. Well, with that, I want to wrap up today, Scott. It was awesome to have the conversation. Thank you for joining me on The Distribution, and I look forward to the next time we can chat.
Thank you, Brandon. It was a great time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.